How to live with questions you can't answer. That's tonight's topic. There is a very widespread picture of how science works. The picture goes like this. Something happens, and we'd like to know why. So we think and think and think and think, and cook up an explanation. Some kind of theory which, if it were true, would explain why it happens. Of course, that's not enough, then you have to test the theory. And you devise experiments. If this theory is really true, then when I call up my brother on the telephone, he'll hang up and won't talk to me. Or something else. You know, when I heat the stuff up, it'll turn green. Or something else. And then you do an experiment to see whether the theory passes the test. As long as the theory passes the test, then you hold on to it. The minute it fails the test, you know the theory is false. So you just throw away that theory, and then you go back to square one and think and think and think until you come up with another theory. This picture is, I think, very widespread in the non-scientific community, and it's surprisingly widespread among scientists who ought to know better. The picture is entirely false. It has nothing to do with the way science is done. The bottom line is, there has never been a scientific theory ever proposed without known counterexamples. There never has been a scientific theory that could explain everything that it was supposed to explain. Not only that it can't explain, but without known counterexamples. I heard this from a philosopher for whom I have very little respect in other things that he has written and said, Richard Rorty of Princeton. I heard him say it at the National Philosophy Convention 30 years ago, and I was struck by the point of the remark. He said, therefore, when you change one theory for another, what you're doing is trading in one theory with its problems for another theory with its problems, because there never has been a theory without problems. And he said, we have no good description of how that's done, why it's done, what the criteria are, what the explanation is. We have no good theory of how that's done. That's something which is very subtle and is an outstanding problem in philosophy of science. I thought that was a very profound remark. Let me give you some examples. Let me give you some examples of the kinds of problems that were known to afflict theories that were accepted by everybody. Ptolemy created a system of astronomy in which everything goes around the Earth and everything goes around in circles. It's just that if everything's going around in circles around the Earth, it works terribly. Things just aren't where they ought to be. When you look for the moon, it won't be there. And the planets, things are going to go terribly wrong. So then he said, well, we could modify it like this. Everything goes around in circles. Circle is a perfect motion. Everything has to go out in circles. But the Earth doesn't have to be at the center of all the circles. They go around the Earth, but the Earth's not at the center, off center. That helps. For the moon, it doesn't help enough. The moon is very, very complicated. So then he said, okay, everything goes around in circles, but you could have circles on the circles. Those of you, a big circle, and then on the big circle, there are little circles, which means that the planet or the sun or whatever it is goes around in a kind of sine curve, a miniature sine curve going around the big circle. It's all circles. It's circles on circles. They're called epicycles. Sometimes you headed epicycles on the epicycles. It was very complicated. Now, the person who taught me this was Professor Sternberg at Harvard. I wasn't a student at Harvard, but he happens to be a Frum Jew, and he was the youngest professor ever in the history of Harvard. He was a full professor at the age of 28. In mathematics. He skipped undergraduate school. He came to Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate student. He sat in on the first math lecture. He said to the professor, this course is a waste of my time. I know everything you're going to teach. The professor said, show it to me. And in 3 hours, he outlined the entire semester, and they put him straight into graduate school. He just skipped the first 4 years. Anyway, he taught us the Rambam's Ilchos Kiddush HaChodesh, Maimonides' Laws of Sanctifying the New Moon, And there's a complete course of Ptolemaic astronomy. And he pointed out that if you take the moon going around in its circle, with its epicycles, the curlicues. And of course the earth is not at the center of the circle, as Ptolemy said, then the distance from the earth to the moon is going to vary. It's not going to be constant. And if you'll take, in any month, the closest distance and the furthest distance of the moon from the earth, the difference is a factor of 2. Okay, now when something gets twice as far away from you, it looks how much smaller? Well, it looks 1/4 as big. It looks 1/4 as big. That's a sizable difference. That's an easily visible difference. If you have a thing in the sky and then suddenly it shrinks to 1/4 of its size, that's an easily visible difference. We don't see anything like that. The moon stays the same size except at the horizon when it looks like it's bigger. But during the month, we don't see any change in the size of the moon. This was a glaring refutation of the Ptolemaic system that everybody knew about. Everybody, go through 1 month and you see it for yourself. Why didn't people give it up? It's clearly wrong. So, there was some suggestion by historians that maybe they didn't think of the heavenly bodies as physical objects. Who knows what they are? And therefore the idea of the size never occurred to them, but it is a glaring hole in the theory. That didn't mean they gave up the theory. Here's another example. This is in a book by a fellow named Harrison called Darkness at Night. It was published by Harvard. According to the Newtonian view of the universe, it's infinitely big and roughly homogeneous. There's stars and planets and dust and all sorts of stuff scattered in roughly equal amounts throughout the infinity. Okay, I'm sitting here on the surface of the earth. I point my finger at the sky. Now imagine a line going out from my finger. And it goes and goes and goes and goes. Eventually, it's going to hit a star. Because there's an infinity of them out there. And if you think of the stars, a little more technical, you think of the stars in shells, right? The further out you go, the bigger the shell is. But if the density is constant, the more stars you have. So you've got a shell with so many stars, another shell with the same amount covered, another shell with the same amount covered. Eventually, unless somebody's out there gerrymandering the stars, they all hide behind one another. Right? If they aren't doing that, eventually your finger's going to hit a star. Okay. Now, of course, I pointed my finger arbitrarily. However you point your finger at the sky, eventually that line's going to hit a star. A star. A star that's shining. Because for them, the stars were themselves inexhaustible. They never changed. They've been always shining. Always shining. So, if that's true, the universe goes on to infinity, and it's infinitely old, it has no beginning. So then, wherever that star is, that my finger's line is going to hit, light ought to be coming in on that line. And there's plenty of time for that light to get here, because the universe is infinitely old. The star's been shining from forever. So that means light is coming in on every line from the heavens. Well then, how come it ever gets dark? Every night you have a visible refutation of this Newtonian view of the universe. That's why it's called the book Darkness at Night. This was a known paradox. It was known already in the 17th century. In the 18th century, astronomer named Olbers resurrected it and publicized it, so it goes by the name of Olbers' paradox. But it was 100 years, it was known 100 years before that. So some people said, maybe the universe, you know, somebody forgot to sweep up. There's all sorts of dust out there which will block the starlight. That worked for a decade or so until somebody said, wait a minute, if that dust is catching the starlight and has been catching the starlight from forever, well, starlight has energy. So eventually the dust is going to heat up. And when the dust heats up, it's going to glow. And when it glows, it's going to send out its own light. Well, a lot of the solutions were tried. No solution was satisfactory. Now, here you have the whole of the scientific community maintaining this view of the universe, the Newtonian view of the universe, with a known, clear, paradoxical result. Now, let me just finish the illustration because I want to get to a general point, and then we can go back and discuss them if you like. Quantum mechanics. I'm not going to go through the details, it's complicated, but there's one little thing you should know. In the 1930s, when they tried to do the quantum mechanical calculation, how much energy does an electron have? One single electron. The answer was infinity. That's not right. It's not right that each electron has an infinite amount of energy. I hope you appreciate that, right? It would just squash out the whole universe. No, it's desperately, desperately wrong. Did they give up the theory? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. These are illustrations of what Rorty said. That every theory from its inception has had known counterexamples. Known refutations. So when the scientific community accepts a theory, it's not because it solves all problems. That's not the reason. Because if so, they never would have accepted any theories. Because every theory lived with unsolved problems. Not only unsolved problems, but counterexamples. It's not that we don't know how to solve it. It's a counterexample. The theory says something, we know it's wrong. So what then is the attitude? The attitude is, yes, it is a counterexample. And we should do something to take care of it. But who knows what that something is? Will the adjustment that we have to make strike at the heart of the theory? So that its very fundamentals have to be changed? Or maybe something peripheral, maybe we're making an extra assumption somewhere which we could do without and save the fundamentals of the theory. It's a kind of bet that when we solve it, the theory will be maintained in all of its important assertions, and only something peripheral will have to be modified. Now, in the case of darkness at night, that was not true. What you needed was units of a finite age, which was a radical change from their worldview. In the case of the infinite electron, in the late 40s and 50s, the scientists invented a new mathematical technique. Here's the technique. You're calculating away, and you're getting into the realm of the infinity, so subtract infinity. If you subtract the infinity, then the infinity doesn't show up. You see? Then you get the right answer. Of course, why are you subtracting infinity? So I don't get an infinity, that's why. Is that reasonable? Is that justifiable? Do we understand what it says about the physical world to subtract infinity to make sure that you don't get it? Many physicists are doubtful about explaining it, but it works, so they just keep chugging along, right? This is how science really works. There are always known problems, always known counterexamples, and you live with it, hoping that some minor adjustment will take care of it. In the Yeshiva Lashon, we say, Mishtapne from Akasha. You don't die from Akasha. Okay, you have a position, Akasha is raised. Good, I can't answer the Akasha. Fine, we'll continue to think about it, and we'll continue to work with it. You don't give up just because the kasha is raised. This is something which the scientific world takes for granted. This is something which the Torah world takes for granted. This is something that any rational person trying to understand the world takes for granted. The mere fact that you have counterexamples does not mean you give up your position. As I said, you're making an estimate, if I'm going to handle this counterexample, where will the adjustment have to come? Assuming the counterexample was not just a mistake. That has happened too. People thought that there was a deduction, and it wasn't really a deduction. But other than that, if it isn't a mistake, the adjustment might be a minor adjustment and might not touch any of the fundamentals of my theory, and therefore, I don't have to give up on the theory. So when you're maintaining a theory and you have outstanding questions you can't answer, counterexamples you can't refute, you're estimating the strength of the theory versus the strength and the centrality of the counterexamples. The Talmud is filled. Talmud has many places, hundreds of places, where the end of the discussion is kasha. It's an objection we can't answer. They didn't hide this from the eyes of the naive faithful who might be devastated by the fact there's an unanswered question. When I was looking into Torah, I was not religious, this was one of the most encouraging things that I saw. This is a system that criticizes itself and is willing to admit when there's a problem that they can't answer. That's a system that has honesty, objectivity, and enough self-confidence that these questions don't undermine the validity of the theory as a whole. That's my first point about how to live with questions that you can't answer. Now, you had a question you want to raise?
I've heard that as a body of light gets further away, it dims. So about the theory that says it's dark there because the bodies of light are just further away?
This is a theory that you mean is further away or is moving further away? Is further away. Well, this is a theory which people have suggested, the tired light theory, for which there is absolutely no experimental evidence whatsoever. No one has ever measured it. No one has ever produced it in the laboratory. It is a hypothesis without any experimental evidence whatsoever. And it was proposed for a variety of reasons, but it's a hope, but without any experimental evidence whatsoever, it's something which I don't know any scientist would take it seriously. Yeah.
What makes the theory acceptable in the first place? Why does it get taken on?
So you're trying to understand the phenomenon. The theory, if true, would explain the phenomenon to you. The problems are there, and the explanation will work if the problems can be solved in such a way as to leave the basic structure of the theory intact. And the bet of the community is, yes, we'll be able to handle the counterexamples eventually, leaving the structure of the theory intact.
So the problem is smaller than any competing theory, in other words?
I'm not talking about competing theories now. I haven't spoken about competing theories. You asked how a theory is accepted in the first place.
Well, right? Assuming that there are other theories to choose
from. Oh, so then you're back to what Rorty said. Right. When you choose one theory over another, you're choosing one theory with its problems over another theory with its problems.
Less problems.
Well, it's not clear that the problems are less. They may be a different kind, or the internal structure of the theory may be so much superior that you're willing to buy more problems. When Galileo used his telescope was terrible. And people knew that. When you looked at images on the Earth, you got double images. So trusting it for the moons of Jupiter was a big jump. Nevertheless, the theory that he came up with altogether was superior in its structure. The predictions made by the Galilean theory for the positions of the planets and the rest were worse than Ptolemy. The Ptolemaic predictions were better. But people felt that the Ptolemaic predictions were made on the basis of an unreality. Circles and circles on circles and not being the center of the circle. It struck people. What I'm telling you now is just hash, right? I mean, I'm not explaining it. I'm telling it to you in intuitive terms that does no good. People felt that it wasn't believable or it wasn't trustable or it didn't fit into other ways of looking at the world. This is why Rorty says we don't have a way of describing this. You're dealing with, it's sort of like asking a chess master, why did you take the bishop? And his answer is, because I'll probably win the game, that's why. I have a feeling for the center of the board. For me, the center of the board is very important. For somebody else, it isn't so important. That's how he plays. He plays for the center of the board, and he's a chess master. He can't explain it in any more precise terms than that. I can't do any better for this either. In science, the correct construction of scientific theories and the choice of them is something which we understand very poorly. Yeah.
So when should it...
When should a deduction be made? When should it mean the theory is out? I don't think we have any criterion for that. No one guessed that darkness at night would sink the Newtonian theory. Now, other things, tipped it over the scale. But as a matter of fact, the way we look at it today, there was no solution in Newtonian terms for the darkness at night problem. Their hope that they would solve it on the periphery was vain. There was no way to solve it on the periphery. You have to have a radically different picture of the universe in order to solve it. So the hope, now, on the other hand, the hope that the infinite electron will go away, if you believe in renormalization, it did go away. So that hope was fulfilled. So how to predict beforehand which ones... today you have a gigantic problem. Quantum mechanics and relativity contradict one another. What to do? Most scientists think that relativity has to give way. Roger Penrose, who is arguably one of the world's greatest scientists, thinks that quantum mechanics has to give way. Nobody really knows. It'll be solved when someone will come up with a better theory and solve the contradictions, if that will ever happen. In the meantime, they're just guessing. So I don't think you have any way to know beforehand how it's going to work out. Yeah.
Rob, can you give an outline as to what these two theories
I can give you a bibliography. I can't. It'll take too long. Brian Greene's book, The Elegant Universe, is a very good, has a very good exposition of it. But any book that deals with cosmology will have explanations of it. It'll take us too far afield. Anyway, that's the first point that I wanted to make. Now, secondly, I want to give you some examples of outstanding problems that we can't solve and show you how we live with them in particular. But it's important to know, you see, sometimes our job is to give you answers. And we can give you lots of answers. I'm afraid that sometimes we may give the impression that basically everything's worked out and there aren't any outstanding problems. Oh, it's not true. There are definitely outstanding problems, and we learn to live with them. The Torah teaches that we have free will. Free will works something like this. I have to make a decision. Already in me are various motivations, desires, hopes, fears, scruples, values, habits, pleasure, pain, any number of inbuilt motivations. And when I have to make a choice between A and B, these motivations will come to play. Some will be more in favor of A, some will be more in favor of B. Some will agree. Say both of them are good or both of them are bad. So I have in me this interplay of motivations. Now, if my action were just the result of that interplay of motivations, then I would be a programmed machine. But no, in addition to all of those motivations, there's something else called free will. And free will sometimes can make the difference. If the innate motivations, well, the ones that are present at the time of the action, say innate, that has other connotations, the ones that are present at the time of the action, aren't too unbalanced, if they aren't too unbalanced, then free will can push the decision one way or the other. If they're too unbalanced, then free will has no purchase. Free will doesn't have unlimited leverage. One philosopher gave the following example. You're standing next to a pool, and an 18-month-old child falls into the pool. Now, you're the only one standing next to the pool. All you have to do is lean down, grab his shirt, and pull him out. If you do that, you'll save his life. It'll cost you nothing. He's an 18-month-old child. He doesn't weigh anything. And you won't even get your pants dirty. You won't have to go to the cleaners. What is there in your motivation in favor of pulling him out? Well, you're saving a human life, and the parents will love you forever, and they'll have the respect of all your friends, and you have your own satisfaction. What is there in your motivation against pulling him out? It says the author, if you're a normal person, nothing at all. There's absolutely nothing telling you, yeah, let him drown. Under those conditions, said the author of this paper, you're not exercising free will. Free will means that you're pulled in at least two directions, maybe 17, but at least two directions, and free will decides. But if there's no pull in the other direction, then it's not exercise of free will. So, you have to imagine that you're pulled in two directions, and the pulls are, they don't have to be exactly equal, but they shouldn't be too unbalanced, and then free will casts the deciding vote. Now, the one assumption governing the whole picture is that if my motion, yeah, I didn't say action this time, I said motion. If my motion were produced by an external force causing me to move, then it certainly wouldn't be an action. Action has to come from me. I can't just be lifted by a hurricane and dropped in someplace. That's not an action. That's something that happens to me. Okay, given this picture, the Stoics, 1800 years ago, said, this picture suffers from a terrible problem. We can show you, said the Stoics, that if this is your picture of how free will works, then there can't be any such thing as human responsibility. The way you're picturing it, you're never responsible for anything you do. Why not? Well, they said, there are really only two choices. Either that free will module, that's the way they talk now, right? The mind is made of modules interacting with one another. Jerry Fodor and company. Going back to Chomsky. That free will module,
either that free will module operates according to rules, or it does not operate according to rules. Does seem to be the only two choices, right? Either it does operate according to rules, or it doesn't operate according to rules. And said the Stoics, either choice will get you into trouble. Precisely the trouble we're talking about. Let's see. Imagine that free will operates according to rules. Okay, so now, I have these two alternatives, A and B. What shall I do? Well, let's see. According to monetary outcome, A gets 6 points and B gets 12 points. According to pain and pleasure, A gets 13 points and B gets 4. According to values, A gets 19 points and B gets 6. According to fears, A gets 3 points and B gets 29. Calculate it out. Go through each of the dimensions. Get up a sum. Total it up and do the one with the biggest number. That would mean free will is following a rule. Well, said the Stoics, if free will is following the rules, where did the rules come from? How come free will is following those rules? Is it that God made it that way? Then there's an external force that's determining what you do. Is it that your parents brought you up that way? Then there's an external force determining what you do. Is it that your culture influenced you? Acculturated you that way? Then it's your culture, that's an external force that's determining what you do. When you account for where the rules the free will is coming, come from, you will see, is it the DNA from your parents? Then it's an external force that's determining what you do. If free will operates according to rules, then it's traceable to an external force, which means you're not doing it and you're not responsible. Ah, you say, okay, I hear that. What about the other alternative? Free will operates without rules. Without rules. So here's A, and here's B. Now what does free will do? Well, it looks at A, looks at B. If it has some more time, look at A again, look at B again, and it'll say, B! And how did it choose B? What about B attracted it? What was the motivating factor? Nothing. It was a completely arbitrary choice. Because if you say, it was the money in B, or it was the value in B, or it was the desires in B, so then you're back to a rule. If you're not using a rule, then the choice has to be arbitrary. If the choice is arbitrary, you can hardly be held responsible for having in your personality a module that pops off for no reason at all. That's just an arbitrary element, a random element. Indeed, if it helps, you can program a computer to do things on the basis of a random element also. That would make the computer responsible for what it does. So the Stoics said, you have two choices. Either free will operates according to rules, in which case it's an external cause, which you say is not you're not responsible for. Or it doesn't operate according to rules, in which case the choice is arbitrary, random, accidental, in which case you're not responsible either. And therefore, said the Stoics, according to your picture, you can't account for responsibility at all. This is a bomb of a problem. Contemporary philosophy has no answer to this problem. Let's put it a little differently. There are about 5% of contemporary philosophers who think they have an answer, but everybody else disagrees with them. Right? Timothy O'Connor and Indiana and other people think they have an answer in what they call agent causation, but nobody else agrees with them. So philosophy as a whole certainly doesn't have an answer. It's an unanswered question. And so far as I know, our sources don't answer it either. I don't know all of our sources. It could be that I'm missing something, but people I've talked to, there's no answer to this question. So here we are sitting with a question which is really, for us, quite central. Free will is one of our main axioms. And there's a paradox right at the heart of the idea of free will. You with me so far? Yeah.
I disagree with your point that if the factors influencing, if the factors given choice between A and B, the balance is not there, that means you don't have an optimum amount of free will, because say given A and B and the factors influencing A are much greater than the factors influencing B, then you choose B, then are you not generating the optimum amount of free will by choosing B?
The argument is that you can't choose B. Free will doesn't operate if there's too big an imbalance between the motivations for A and the motivations for B. So you ask, why is that? Well, all I can do is refer you to the example of the drowning child. Is it obvious to you there?
that you're not exercising free will? No. It's not obvious. Well, then I don't know what else to say to you. Unless maybe there's one other thing that's going on in your mind, which really, really does fit the description I'm giving, but may not be obvious. You could imagine, I suppose, a situation like this. All my desires and all my fears and all my hopes and all my worries and profit and play and pain and pleasure, all of them say do A. But I know B is right. I know B is right. Can't I choose B just knowing it's right against all of my other motivations in favor of A? I think you can. But that's because, given that you know that B is right, you automatically have a desire to do B. No, it doesn't have to be greater. It doesn't have to be greater. It doesn't have to be balanced. I said that. But it isn't 100% against zero. The knowledge that something is right automatically means that you have a desire to do it. It just may not be your strongest desire. The knowledge that something is right automatically provides a motivation to do it. So it again will be motivation against motivation. If you thought that you have a knowledge that's right against all your motivation and didn't appreciate that knowing that it's right automatically involves a desire, I'm using vague terminology here. Thomas Nagel, one of the best contemporary philosophers, wrote a very famous book called The Possibility of Altruism 30 years ago, in which he argued that knowledge can produce desire. He talked about motivated desires, where they're motivated by knowledge. That was a very radical position. I think he's right. But there's a lot of discussion of it. When you come to the conclusion of something right, that will give birth to a desire. Desires aren't willy-nilly. Not all of them. Some are, but some are not. If you say it's not that way, you say the desire has to be co-opted from someplace else, I don't mind. The Hume style, I really don't mind. The point is, when you talk about knowing it's right, that definitely involves a desire to do it. So then you got motivation against motivation again. Okay, so now what are we going to do about this? Right? This strikes at the heart of our axiom, the axiom that we have free will. There are two ways out. One way is to notice that the concepts that are used to build this problem are very poorly understood concepts. We're talking about responsibility and rules and randomness and cause. Each of those is a concept that is debated and discussed and investigated in contemporary philosophy. Every year there are books that come out on each of those concepts, and those books are soundly refuted by the end of the year, and new books come out the next year. They're very complicated, subtle, and poorly understood concepts. Is it really such a shock that with four poorly understood concepts, when we mix them together, we come out with a paradox? Compare the situation with Zeno's paradoxes of motion. Zeno was a guy who lived before Socrates. We don't have his writings, but Aristotle preserved some of his arguments. He had three proofs that nothing moves. Three proofs that nothing can move. I'll give you two out of the three, just to give you the flavor of what's going on. Imagine an arrow that flies from A to B. That's the way we say, right? Now, pick any moment in its flight. At that moment, where's the arrow? The arrow's in one space, one spot, the spot where it is at that moment, right? And that's true at any moment. Pick any moment you like, the arrow's in one spot. Of course, if a thing is in one spot, it's not moving, right? Right. Okay, so now, at every moment in the flight, it's in one spot. That means at every moment in the flight, it's not moving. So when is it moving? That was one of his arguments. The other argument was, if you believe in motion, you must believe that if you have a handicap race, you know what a handicap race is? A runs faster than B, so you give B a head start. Right? And that makes it interesting. Can B overtake A before the end of the race? That's what they do. With horses, with people, sometimes handicap race. Zeno said, in a handicap race, the guy behind can never catch up to the guy in front. I'll prove it to you. Imagine the race starts like this. Okay, I'm sorry for the tape that we don't have a video here. Right? So when the gun fires, here's where they are. Now the guy behind runs faster. That's why he gave the guy in front a head start. Alright? Stage one of the race is this. You have them both run until the guy behind reaches where the guy in front was. The guy in front has been running. So he gets somewhat further ahead. Somewhat less than he was before, but he gets somewhat further ahead. That's stage one. Stage two, the guy behind runs up to where the guy in front is now. But while he's running up to where the guy was now, then of course the guy in front is running ahead. Maybe a little bit less, but he is getting ahead, right? That's stage two. Can you guess what stage three is? I'll bet you can. Right? The guy behind runs up to where the guy in front is now, and the guy in front runs ahead a little bit further, right? And you can follow out stage four and stage five and stage 259, stage 4,963, and stage 2 billion. When is he going to pass? At which stage is he going to pass? Every stage, wherever he was behind, the guy behind runs up to where the guy in front is. But while he's running up to where the guy in front is, the guy in front's running a little bit further ahead. Maybe less, but he's running a little further ahead. He's never going to get past him. Right? Because there's no end of stages. You're not going to run out of stages. That was one of his arguments.
Does this guy ever attend any kind of base or...
Now listen. This is very important now. Now listen. It took 2,300 years to figure out what was wrong with his arguments. Only in the 19th century, when they created the foundations of the continuum, Dedekind and Weierstrass, was it agreed upon by most that these paradoxes were solved. 2,300 years these arguments stood. Did anybody think that motion is an illusion? That nothing moves? You know, after 2,000 years, maybe we're wrong. This guy cooked up these arguments. Nobody could answer them. Maybe we're wrong. Maybe nothing really moves. It's all an illusion. It's all a dream. Nobody thought that. Everybody was convinced, rightly, logically, that there is motion, even though they couldn't answer the arguments. Now, here you have arguments based on space, time, and motion. Those are concepts we use all the time. We use them very successfully and with great agreement. I'll meet you July 5th, 2007, in downtown Dallas at 4 p.m. And we're both there at the same time and same place. How do we do that? Because we understand space, time, and motion very well. We can navigate with it. We can predict where planets will appear. We do it very well. And even so, that these are concepts that we use all the time, we understand very well, we all agree on them, Zeno was able to cook up this paradox. Is it shocking that four concepts that we don't understand well, that we have no end of difficulty with, that we have lots of controversy about, is it shocking that we cooked up a paradox with those four concepts? The first diagnosis is the paradox is due to our poor understanding of these concepts. And as the concepts will be clarified, if they will ultimately be clarified, the paradox will just go away the way Zeno's paradox went away. Yeah?
Just a question to that, going back again. Can he catch up with him and go further?
Of course he can. We all experience that. Question is, how do you square it with the argument? What do you do about the argument? You know, I must tell you, the vast, vast majority of people in the world, you have an argument to a silly conclusion. Everybody says, yeah, but the conclusion is false. We know that. And they go home. There's 0.001% of the people who say, yeah, but why was the argument false? Nobody else cares about that. It's just philosophers who care about that. And it took 2,300 years for people to figure out what was wrong with the argument. Yeah.
According to that theory, every piece of space should be infinite because you split it in half and keep splitting it.
Well, infinite what? Infinitely splittable?
Infinitely...
One second.
Distance.
No, I don't see why. All you get from this is that it's infinitely divisible. But infinitely divisible doesn't mean it's infinitely big. Shouldn't have to mean it's infinitely big. Why would you say that? But the pieces get smaller. The pieces always get smaller, right? The pieces always get smaller. Now, what they couldn't do up until the middle of the 19th century was add an infinite number of terms. They couldn't add an infinite number of terms. We can, sort of. We sort of pretend using the limits definition of infinity, right? And we use that to explain what it means to add an infinite number of terms. They didn't have that concept. For them, if you have an infinite number of terms, then you've hit a block that you can't get beyond. By the way, the third argument was working it backwards. How does a person starts to walk? How does he ever get started? Before you go the whole way, you got to go halfway. Before you go halfway, you got to go a quarter of the way. Before you go a quarter of the way, you got to go an eighth of the way. Right? So you're going to go a 16th of the way? No, before you do that, you got to go a 32nd of the way. Right? Before you go a 32nd, you go a 64th of the way. How do you even get started? What's your first step? A 32nd? Oh, you had to do a 64th before that. Right? So you could never get started. Okay, so that's because they didn't have the mathematical definitions to handle an infinite series. Once you had that, most people think that the problems collapse. But it took 2,300 years to do that. That's one way out. So, we're not solving the problem, but similar to what I said about the scientific problems, I'm judging that the problem will be solved at the periphery. I'm not going to have to change my concept of human beings' responsibility and the way human beings act. Something about... Let me say that again. I'm not going to change my mind that people are responsible for their actions and that they do have free will. I'm going to have to change my definition of responsibility and randomness and cause and rule so as to accommodate those principles. But the principles that people do have free will and they're responsible for their actions, those principles are not going to be given up. That's the heart of the theory. And the heart is not going to be affected by the adjustments at the periphery. That's one way to live with it. The other way to live with it, from our point of view, is this. Free will is an exercise of the soul. Should we expect to understand what the soul does? Is that something which falls into the realm which our minds are designed to analyze and appreciate? Not according to our sources. Our sources tell us that the human mind, as it operates in our world, is the result of a giant reduction. The soul has the ability to understand on an infinitely grander scale, with infinitely greater depth and infinitely broader grasp than we are exercising today. We've been given enough use of the mind to function within our physical world. To function in our physical world and to relate to God in it, that's as much mind as we are exercising. Adam, when he was created, before our world came into existence the way it is today, his mind was infinitely greater than ours. So, the workings of the soul, which reflect something of God's own nature, we are created in God's form, from our point of view, it is not shocking to think that we're not intended to understand this. We're not able to understand this. And therefore, a paradox of this nature, concerning this subject, doesn't move us too much. We're more or less primed to expect that sort of thing. In which case, we wouldn't have to modify our theory at all, because our theory tells us that this is something which we could expect. So here's one problem that we know that we have to live with, at least for the time being, and there are two ways to live with it. You with me? I'll give you one more example. The Ramban had a disputation with a Jew who had gone over to the Catholic religion, who had all sorts of complaints against Judaism. The king of Aragon in Spain forced the Ramban to participate. The truth is, the king was a friend of the Ramban's. They were friendly, and the king apologized and said, "The church is pushing me into this. I can't get out of it. Please do this for me." So he did it. After 3 days of the Ramban's answering the challenges of this renegade Jew, and by the way, it's all written up. The Ramban wrote the dialogue out, and we have it, and it's even translated in English. I think it's called a disputation. It's in Rabbi Chevelle's 4-volume collected writings of the Ramban, both in the Hebrew and the English. At the end, the Ramban says to the king, "I've been answering questions for 3 days. Could I ask a question?" And the king says, "Sure, go ahead." And the Ramban says to this renegade Jew, "You guys believe in 3 and 1, right? The God is 3 and God is 1. Exactly. Exactly 3 and exactly 1. Says the Ramban, "How is that? How does it get to be exactly 3 and exactly 1? Is it like 3 peas in a pod? 3 peas in one pod?" So he says, "No. Is it like 3 attributes of one thing? You know, the water is both warm and transparent and pH of 7? No. Well, so you tell me, what is it like, the 3 and 1? And the guy says, We can't tell you what it's like. We just believe it. The Rabban said, if you can't tell me what it's like, if you can't define it for me, then you can't believe it either. And that's the end of the discussion. Now, let's think about that. If you can't define it, you can't believe it. Gosh, aren't there lots of things that we believe in that we can't define, we can't explain, we can't describe, we can't... We believe that God created the world out of nothing. Something came out of nothing. How is that? Why is that? When is that? What makes it happen? What's the mechanism that underlies it? We haven't got a clue. Our writings don't give us a clue about that. We believe it anyway. So what do you mean? You can't believe it unless you can define it, describe it, explain it, understand it. What's Ramban talking about? Oh, okay, let me, I'm glad you asked that. I was going to put it later, but let's stop to talk about it now. All I know about the Kabbalah is what the Ramchal writes. There may be other views that I'm ignorant of. When I started to look into some of the books, my Rebbe told me, you have to know that in the Kabbalah, there are differences of opinion, just as there are differences of opinion about chickens. Don't be shocked when there are differences of opinion in the Kabbalah. The Ramchal says, how physical substance comes out of, even that's not the right way to say, how it comes into existence due to God, who is not physical at all, how that happens is something we have no information on whatsoever. The whole of the Kabbalah does not address that question. Not relevant to that question. And those of you who are sitting here, you probably don't know about this, but I don't know who's going to listen to the recording. If you think that the Kabbalah is an imitation of Neoplatonism, which seems to have a picture of how that happens, cancel it. You are misunderstanding the model for the reality. In Hebrew, you're misunderstanding the mashal for the nimshal. The physical sounding terminology of the process of creation has nothing to do with the physical world. Withdrawal in the empty space and then filling the space has nothing to do with withdrawal, has nothing to do with empty space, has nothing to do with filling the space. Indeed, look at the sources carefully. When God, so-called, so to speak, withdraws and leaves the empty space, it's not empty! But it's filled! The halal is filled. I halal means empty space, that's modern Hebrew. The Ramchal says this explicitly, that the halal is filled with something called the reshimo. It's definitely not empty. So the whole idea of space is only a mushel. It's only a mushel. It's a little bit like saying, that's a very deep idea. Someone will ask, 20 feet deep? 30 feet deep? 40 feet deep? How deep did you mean, sir? I said, excuse me, you just didn't get it. I didn't mean deep like that. I didn't mean it was physically deep. I deep is a physical term. That's a very hard question. Is it harder than diamonds or softer than diamonds? Sorry, didn't mean that either. Hard for questions doesn't mean like hard for diamonds. You're misunderstanding the word hard as if it were a physical term. When you apply it to questions, it's not physical. Here, too, space isn't space, and withdrawal isn't withdrawal, and it just has nothing to do with that. It has to do with a different realm altogether. So the idea of how our physical world, well, not only the physical world, the spiritual world as well. How do souls come into existence? A soul is a created thing, created from nothing. And even from nothing, someone told me the other day, oh, you're not making sense. It's created from nothing. Nothing is the thing that it's created from. That's like saying, there's no one there? How old is he? You said that no one is there. So how old is he, right? You know, no one is there. It's not the name of the person who's there. It means there is empty. That's what it means, right? Created from nothing doesn't mean there's a nothing it was created from. It means it has no antecedents. Before it was not what it came out of. This idea that something is there and nothing precedes it and God is responsible for it is an idea for which we have no explanation whatsoever. Not in any of our sources, says Ramchal. Okay, so what did the Ramban mean? Ramban meant this, I believe. There are different types of lack of understanding. They're not all equal. You're talking about an idea, a thing. You might not understand how it is. You might not understand why it is. And you might not understand what it is. They are very different. In science, very often, we are investigating how and why something happens. We see it happening, we don't have a clue as to how and why it does happen. We have cases like that all the time. Turns out that, I think it's locusts. They took thousands and thousands of locusts and they enclosed them in a certain area. And they're flying around randomly. When the locusts come to a certain density, then they all start flying together. They all fly together in a swarm. Just the density, it seems. You know, when they're flying around randomly, randomly you'll get a pocket of them. When you get a pocket of them, they all start flying together in one stream. Nobody has a clue why that happens. They're trying to figure it out. What is it in them? What do they sense? How does the steering mechanism work? It's one of the unsolved problems of biology. One of a trillion unsolved problems. Right? We know what's happening. We don't know why it's happening. We don't know how it's happening. Right? The universe is accelerating in its expansion. That's what the observations seem to show. That was a big surprise. When the observations came in 10, 12 years ago, nobody believed them. Everybody thought it was a mistake. Turns out it seems it's not a mistake. It's accelerating its expansion. Why is it doing that? Well, there are a dozen theories, and nobody can be sure whether his theory is right or wrong. How come the galaxies turn around the way they do? There isn't enough gravity to hold them together. Well, there's got to be lots and lots and lots of extra stuff out there providing the extra gravity. A stuff of a type that we've never seen, can't even imagine. And with people guessing what it could possibly be, and there isn't a clue as to what it is. There are lots of unsolved problems. We know what it is. We know what it is. We just don't know why and how. Then, you can understand and believe. We can believe the universe is accelerating its expansion. We can believe that the locusts all of a sudden start to fall. We can see that, so we can certainly believe it, without knowing how and why it is. But if somebody says to me, I'm investigating X. Say, what is X? I don't know. It's just X. But I believe in it. Then there's no belief there because there's no content there. There's no content there to believe. There, I don't have a what. Before you investigate why and how, you have to have a what. If the person doesn't give you a what, there's nothing to talk about. And there's nothing to believe. Now, suppose this guy says, I'm investigating the hidden material that you find in all square circles. What? Wait a minute. You're investigating what? The hidden material you find in all square circles. Really? Where do you investigate this? Where do you find them? I mean, he says, well, I haven't found any yet, but I'm going to investigate all the hidden material that you find in square circles. So listen, you know, I hope you're not asking me to invest in this because you're never going to get started. Square circles? Square circles isn't a thing. It's just nonsense. The words don't mean anything. You haven't provided a what to be investigated. Now Ramban said to this renegade Jew, you're telling me that God is one, exactly, no more and no less. And God is three, exactly, no more and no less. Boy, when you say those words, I don't get it. You know, no idea goes in up here. It's just, you know, like the chattering of the monkeys or the chirping of the birds. It's, you know, exactly one, exactly three, you know, and equal is, I just don't hear anything. And the guy says, you're right, I don't hear anything either, to tell you the truth. You know, to me it's also just chattering, but I believe it. Says the Ramban, if you don't hear anything, you don't believe it either. There's nothing there to believe. Now, I want to take this another step further and show you how there's a fairly subtle point to be made here. The Torah says that at Sinai, we saw the voices. We saw the voices. What does that mean? This is not synesthesia. In synesthesia, you have cross-wiring in the brain where when you hear trumpets, you see red. Or when you see red, you hear trumpets. That's not what we're talking about because there you see red and you hear trumpets. You're seeing a color and you're hearing a sound. It's just that the one causes the other, which is unusual. For most people, they don't have that. Here we're talking, the Torah's vocabulary is, we saw the voices. If you look in English translations, they will fudge and translate it perceived. They perceive the voices. That isn't what it says. It says saw. And Chazal say, Roim is a kolos, Roim is a nishma. They saw that which is heard. Now, what do those words mean to me? Seeing voices to me is just as bad as 3 and 1. It's just the words don't compute. It's just as bad as square circles. Those words don't communicate any idea to my mind. So what do I do with those words? And here's what I do. I say, those words don't communicate any idea to my mind. That doesn't mean they're worthless. That doesn't mean they're worthless. I can imagine someone having an experience utterly unlike mine, and maybe those words would be meaningful to him. So I say, those words have a meaning. I don't know what the meaning is, but they have a meaning. And because they're written in the Torah, those words with that unknown meaning, unknown to me, are true. You know what it's like? It's a little bit like this. I'm following Einstein on a world tour, and he's giving a lecture in China. And surprise, surprise, on the sly, when no one was looking, Einstein learned Chinese. And he gets there in China, and he's giving his lecture in Chinese. I don't understand Chinese. Someone leans over to me and says, what Einstein just said, is it true? So I say, listen, to tell you the truth, I don't understand Chinese. I don't know how he figured this out. You know, he did it when nobody was looking. But knowing Einstein, and knowing the things that he says, and knowing him as I do, how reliable he is, I can tell you confidently that what he said was true, even though I don't know what he said. Similarly here, the Torah is telling me they saw the voices. That doesn't speak to me. Doesn't say anything to me. To me it has no meaning. But if the Torah writes it, then it must be that it has a meaning that I don't appreciate, and that meaning is true. That I can say. That I can say. But I shouldn't pretend that it's meaningful to me, because it isn't meaningful to me. Now, if a Christian would say that, then I don't think we could have any complaint against him. If he would say, I agree with you, 3 and 1 don't mean anything together. It can't be exactly 3 and exactly 1. The way we think about things, that's an absolute contradiction. But my tradition tells me it's got to be true. So whatever it means, I'm sure it's true. That's not the same as saying, I believe it. The it can't be a commitment of my belief now, because the it is unknown to me. I don't know what the it is. I don't know what the meaning is. But I could say it has a meaning, which I don't appreciate, and because I trust my tradition, I'm sure that that meaning is true, whatever it is. Even though I can't believe it, because I don't know what it is. So that you can do. That's another way to live with an unsolved problem, by recognizing there are meanings there that you can't appreciate. If you want a little hint, you know what square roots are? Only positive numbers have square roots. That's because to get a number from the square root, you multiply the square root times itself. Any number times itself is always positive. If the number is negative, times itself is positive. If it's positive, it's positive. You can't get any negative numbers. So the square root of a negative number is nonsense. Now I tell you that modern mathematics makes crucial use of the square root of minus 1. What? Square root of what? It can't be a square root of minus 1. Yeah, I know, they can't be, but they do it anyway. So somebody told me, oh, that's why they called it an imaginary number, right? Because it isn't really a number, and it's just fooling, just play, right? The science physics are all playing, you know, playing is this abstract game, which means nothing. Not exactly. They cooked up a complex plane in which they do physics. So it can't be just meaningless, though it does sound meaningless. So then what you say is, well, the physicists have a secret, that they've concocted this thing, and they're using it somehow, and apparently works, and when I learn physics, I'll figure out how it works. And that's exactly true. When you learn physics, you will figure out how it works. In the meantime, what you know is, it stands for something meaningful, and I don't know what it stands for. Yeah.
I would say that Torah and mathematical theories are analogous, because Torah does not have to be literal. I mean, I can think of a dozen ways to reinterpret the verses as they saw the voices. Mathematics is something that's...
This is crucial. I'll repeat the question for the recording, and then I'll answer. This is very important. He says that mathematics and the Torah aren't analogous, because the Torah is not always literal, And you could think of a dozen ways of interpreting they saw the voices to make it into a literal, meaningful statement. And therefore, I don't have to go the route of something like the square root of minus one. The Torah sources are not available for our free interpretation. They're not available for our free interpretation. The Torah sources, especially the written sources, came together with an oral supplement. The oral supplement, the original oral supplement, came from God, just like the written Torah came from God. It's exactly the same authority. The sages have the authority to interpret the Torah, especially the Sanhedrin, in a way that other people don't. For us, the Tanakh, the Bible, is what the Talmud, the Midrash, and the rest say it is. And the Talmud is for us what the Rishonim say it is. There's no such thing as going there all the way back and interpreting on our own. Here, we actually have a comment. We have a comment in the oral tradition. They saw that which is heard. That means that the oral tradition is telling us, take it literally, that the oral tradition is emphasizing the paradox in it. So to take it some other way is something which we simply cannot do. There is a whole industry today of people learning other information and reinterpreting the Torah to fit the information. That's something which our tradition doesn't allow. And if you think about it a little bit, you see that it's inherently illogical. Because if you do that, then the tradition that you're interpreting has no fixed content whatsoever. Because, as you say, any person with an imagination could think up a dozen ways to interpret and change the meaning of anything into anything. Which means the tradition as a whole has no fixed content. A thing is only a representative of the tradition if the tradition itself interprets it that way. And it has to become from within the tradition's own resources. If it doesn't do that, it's simply free play. And that's the only way, in principle, that I know to combat, let's say, the Christians or the Muslims, who use our texts fancifully to support their religions. And the answer to it is that if you are free to take words and associate them any way you like, then why can't Moses be the nuclear force? And why can't Aaron be gravity, because he's love, right? And love holds things together. And why can't Korach be the force of radioactivity decay, because he's trying to push all the people apart? And you have a proto physics text. And it'll turn out that the Torah is really a text of physics. There's no end to the play that can be done that way.
You can take it in context.
you certainly could, but the context won't help you.
Because the Jews heard, because they witnessed something which was hidden, you could interpret it. That we do know. Could say that to hear something, you don't necessarily have to see that, so they witness something that was hidden from them. That wouldn't be like stretching the point. You'd be incorporating what you...
The truth is, witnessing something that's hidden for them, the truth is, someone with whom I have a great deal of respect, my son, told me that this is the implication of the statement. The implication of the statement. He said it the other way. Voice, hearing and seeing have a very different effect. You can hear in the dark. You can't see in the dark. So when you're in the dark, the way you communicate is by voice. That's why the Talmud of Babylon, when you invite someone to analyze something, say, Toshma, come and hear. Because the tradition says that Babylon is dark. Machshakim Hoshitani. The Baruch Hu placed me in dark places. That refers to Babylon. That means speech, what's heard, is for a condition of darkness. To say that you can see what is heard implies that the communication that's only available for darkness here was raised to the level of light. But that doesn't replace the statement. It's an implication from the statement. Because Chazal say, Roim is anishma. They saw what was heard. So Chazal are telling you that it's to be taken literally. And then my son was reading an implication from it, which I thought was a very beautiful implication. But it doesn't replace the literal statement. There are times when the text is metaphorical. There's no question about it. And when Chazal tells us it's metaphorical, then we have a right to take it that way. but they don't always do that. Okay, these are some illustrations of how to live with questions that you can't solve. I was trying to turn it off, but it keeps going. If I hold it long enough, that's absolutely. Hold it.
All the holes on. Now, so if I do this.